Welcome to Parents' Perspective. I don't know what to do. Elaine was on the phone with Myra, her best friend. Every day this week, Kayla has made such a fuss when we get ready to leave in the morning. I feel like tearing my hair out. Well, Myra began, sometimes four-year-olds can be fussy. Do you think she's sick? No, I've taken her temperature practically daily, Elaine complained. She just cries and clings to the bedpost and whines that she doesn't want to go to daycare. What about having your mom come one morning? Or Mrs. Corrigan next door? Maybe she just needs some downtime, like all of us. I suggested a visit from Grandma, but she just whimpered and said she wanted Jim and me to stay home. Imagine how understanding they'd be at the office if either one of us pulled that one. Yeah, where are flex time and telecommuting when you need them? Myra commiserated. I can't even imagine being home all the time anyway, Elaine sighed. I think I'd be bored out of my mind. From a parent's perspective, what is happening to children in our two-career parents, America? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest has been working and raising children for a number of years. Mary Eberstadt works from home as a research fellow for Stanford University's Hoover Institution. She's consulting editor to Policy Review, the critically acclaimed Journal of Conservative Thought. Her essays and reviews have also appeared in the Weekly Standard, the Wall Street Journal, and Commentary. She is the author of a new book, Home Alone America. Mary and her husband, writer Nicholas Nash Eberstadt, have four children. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Mary.
Thanks very much, Linda. It's a pleasure to be here.
What would you say is the most important factor parents need to consider if they have the option, deciding whether both should work outside the home?
I'm glad you stressed that part about having the option because, of course, a lot of parents don't. And in a society like ours where divorce is easy to come by and half of all kids will grow up without their father in the home at some point, which is the case now, naturally, a lot of people can't be there with their children because they have to put food on the table. This is something I understand very well. As I mentioned in my book, I myself was the daughter of divorced parents who divorced when I was young, of remarriage, of all kinds of trends that are talked about in my book. But all of that said, people who do have a choice would want to know some of the information in my book. My book is about the kinds of problems that kids have now that their parents' generation did not have and their grandparents' generation did not have. The striking thing, if you look at this generation of kids, is that several problems are on the rise, and some of them acutely, that didn't exist before. For example, childhood obesity, which has been the stuff of headline news for the last couple of years, has tripled since the early 1960s. That's one problem that's pretty well known. There's also the fact that there's an epidemic of sexually transmitted disease among teenagers. This epidemic is very well documented in government and medical literature. Of 19 million cases of STDs in the year 2000, for example, half of them were found in the 15 to 24-year-old set. And some of these diseases are very serious, especially for girls. So I have a chapter in my book about that. Now, in addition to those kinds of obvious health problems, we also have other things going on with kids. We have an apparent explosion of mental problems, including depression, anxiety, and a whole host of behavioral problems that go by names like attention deficit disorder and hyperactivity and so on. I have a chapter in my book about those problems and why they might be on the rise. And finally, we also have the problem that millions of kids are taking psychiatric drugs to control these kinds of psychiatric problems. Now, is that an issue or isn't it? I have a long chapter in my book about that, arguing that yes, it is, and that all of these negative trends are connected to the absence of protective and loving adults in many children's lives. These problems connect in different ways to that absence. They're not always the same. But the fundamental problem that a lot of kids don't have enough parents and other loving family around exists. It's acute in this society, I think, and my book is about what might be done about it and what its consequences are.
I guess the first thing somebody might think of is when you talk about the rise of attention deficit disorder and some of these things, How can we tell that it's not just from better reporting and strides in the behavioral sciences and other sciences to target those kinds of things nowadays?
Yes, that's a very good point. And as I emphasize repeatedly in the book, I am not saying that there aren't childhood mental problems or juvenile mental and psychiatric problems, whatever you want to call them. I'm not saying that ADD, ADHD doesn't exist. I'm making a different point, which is that if you look at how quickly the diagnoses have spread, how many millions and millions of kids are now thought to have these kinds of problems, and if you read what the medical experts say, even experts who believe absolutely in these categories and believe in the drugs that are used to treat them, think that they're being overdiagnosed in the child population. So, in other words, even people who swear by the existence of ADD and the use of drugs like Ritalin also think that too many kids are being diagnosed with it. And I quote several such authorities in my book. It seems to me that something else must be going on here. My hypothesis is that in a world where children are spending long hours out of home and away from their parents, children are A, unhappier than they used to be, and B, acting up because they are unhappier. Furthermore, C, I think caregivers, no matter how loving and wonderful, respond differently to children, for example, having a tantrum than parents do. It's very striking to me that the phenomenon of teachers recommending kids for psychiatric treatment is so common now that the state of Connecticut has actually passed a law against it. In other words, they're saying we don't want teachers recommending kids for drugs. Now, let's try and take that apart for a minute. What's going on here in a world where teachers commonly recommend kids for psychiatric evaluation and drugs? What it suggests to me is that it's in the teacher's environment, that is the out-of-home institutional environment, that the kid is acting up in the first place. So maybe we should be asking ourselves, would the child be acting the same way in the familiar environment of the home and perhaps not acting up the way he is in that 11th hour away from home at the end of the school day? It's a question I think all parents would want to ask themselves.
Yeah, I think people have defined home as a place where, A, they have to take you in, and, B, you can misbehave. What do you think is the most prevalent myth about the two-career family with children?
I don't think that there is a myth about that per se so much as a general myth in our society. For decades now, and for very understandable reasons, we have let ourselves be talked into bad ideas. What do I mean by that? I mean, we have let experts minimize the amount of time and care that children need. We live, again, in a society with easy divorce. My book is as much about absent fathers as it is about absent mothers. And in a society with easy divorce, you're going to have experts telling people that this really isn't so bad for the kids, that it's better for them than their parents sticking together through thick and thin. And you know what? I don't think the evidence bears that out. I think when you look at the kinds of problems that kids have, generally speaking, on account of divorce and absent fathers, you see that maybe we should be making more of a case for sticking together. So that's one kind of outcome of the research that I've looked at. I've looked at many other people's research. There's by now a mountain of research on how the children of divorce are more likely to have behavioral problems, more likely to be sad. A lot of this is just consonant with common sense, of course. And I'm not saying this to beat up on all the divorced parents out there. What I'm saying is something different, that if we step back from our own individual stories and we look at what is going on with these particular kids, we can see that we've been sold a bill of goods. We've had bad ideas about how much children need. They need more than we've been told they do, and we need to get to work correcting some of those ideas.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on what's happening to the children of two career families.
Washington, D.C. with Kids, an excellent book by authors Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Mary Eberstadt, author of Home Alone America, about children of two career households.
On the back of your book, there's a comment from author P.J. O'Rourke, who makes the hilarious but poignant remark that parents treat our children worse than we treat our pets. What do you think is happening in the American home in this respect?
Well, P.J. O'Rourke is one of my favorite writers, and I can't possibly improve on his description of the book. But there is a grain of truth in it. Once again, if you take his comparison literally, imagine, in fact, leaving your dog in the house with a key around his neck and letting him let himself in and out whenever he wants to. Imagine giving your dog psychiatric drugs to control his behavior. As a matter of fact, this does happen now, but most veterinarians frown on the practice. I'm not making this up. There are people giving their dogs psychiatric drugs, but most veterinarians think that this is a risky business and that it interferes with the dog's personality. Now, are the dogs better off than an awful lot of kids who are getting these drugs? That's a possibility that we might want to think about. So even though it seems like what P.J. O'Rourke says is over the top, looked at piece by piece, I think there's a lot of wisdom in what he says and a lot to the idea that we don't convince ourselves that dogs are resilient and that we can do anything we want to them, but we do seem to have convinced ourselves of this in the case of our own children.
A lot of wishful thinking going on.
Yes.
Now, some of the results that you have talked about from your research, a lot of this, the behavioral and learning issues. In your book, Home Alone in America, you look at the results of so many two full-time career households, and you're talking a little bit about what you found now, some of the learning issues and the behavioral issues and so forth. What does this predict for the future?
Well, if absent parents and absent family really are as fundamental to these problems as I argue that they are, then we have to take a whole new approach to certain issues. I'll give you an example. The child obesity issue is not going to go away even if you close every McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken tomorrow. Why won't it go away? Because fundamentally the problem is this. A lot of kids are eating without supervision. They're eating out of vending machines, they're eating in those after-school hours, they're eating when they're spending long hours at home by themselves with access to refrigerators and bulging cupboards and not very much exercise. The fundamental problem with child obesity is that there aren't enough people with a long-term interest in the children's health supervising what goes into their mouths. This is why kids are getting heavier. Of course, adults are getting heavier too, and we all know that, but when adults want to stop themselves from getting heavier, what do? Well, rich ones hire a personal trainer and a personal chef to supervise what goes into their mouths and how much exercise they get. What does that tell us about kids and what they need? They need essentially the same thing, which is a responsibility traditionally performed by parents.
Let's take this a step further, because we're talking about things that adults need to do to change. What about this generation that we're raising with all these problems? If we don't change, where are they headed?
One of the things I found worrisome about the research that I turned up was exactly this. It's bad enough what's going on with a lot of kids now, and I don't want to overstate it. Of course, a lot of kids are happy, a lot of kids are well-adjusted, including kids from dual-income homes, divorce homes, kids who are poor, et cetera, et cetera. Kids are resilient. And yet, it seems to me the long-term problem is, how are all of these kids who have grown up without an example of someone sacrificing for them particularly, how are these kids going to be parents themselves when the time comes? How will they know how to nurture when what they've been taught is that nurture is something that can be outsourced? I don't think it's a disastrous situation, but it is something worth wondering about and perhaps researching.
Now, we've raised a generation of young adults who, in many cases, are all high-powered, well-educated young people who then become parents. So many of them have always planned to continue working while raising a family. Is there a time when it's better to go back to work if you have to make a choice during the child-rearing years? I've heard people say, for example, that my child can be cuddled and played with by an outsider when he or she is very, very young. But by the time he's in middle school, I'd better be home.
I don't want to duck the question entirely, but I do think it's the sort of thing that individual families do have to answer for themselves, because the answer will vary. There are certainly teenagers, for example, who are responsible and can go home by themselves, can work after school, can do all kinds of things independently. But one of the findings of my book is that teenagers in particular probably need a lot more time and attention than many of them get. I cite a study of 7,000 teenagers, for instance, which showed that teenagers are more likely to be alone, spend more time alone than they do with family and friends. That is a striking finding. And the problem of sexually transmitted disease being epidemic is obviously related to a lack of supervision. And so is, again, the obesity problem. There are all kinds of reasons why teenagers need their parents around, and perhaps the most important is that they like to see them. I have a chapter in my book that I think would surprise a lot of parents. It's about contemporary music. It's about the kinds of bands that everybody likes to hate, like Tupac Shakur and Blink 182 and Korn and Nickelback and going back to Pearl Jam and Nirvana and, above all, Eminem, every parent's nightmare. If you listen to this music, if you sit down and push past the profanity and listen to it, you will find that the most common theme, the generational signature, you could call it, of this music, is the sense of abandonment. Every one of these bands I've mentioned, and many other best-selling bands too, many more than I can list right now, make a point of returning to this theme. My father walked out, or I never see my dad. My mother is a mess. She can't take care of me. It's very sad music. And again, above all, Eminem is the incarnation of this. Yes, he sings about lots of other things that parents don't like, sex, drugs, rock and roll, etc. That's as old as rock and roll itself. But he and many other singers, as is well documented in this chapter of my book, are singing about something that is new to the music scene, which is the sense of having been abandoned as a child and the thought that it's that abandonment that has made me a bad person, a person full of rage, a person potentially violent. These themes recur over and over, and a funny thing I find is that whenever I talk about this with people, if there's anybody in the room who's under 30, they tend to just nod their heads and smile because they know what's in this music very well, whereas most people who are over 30 are really surprised by it because they've never listened to it. There is nothing dearer to today's teenagers than their music. This is true for many young adults, too. And so to sit down and see what's really in it is to see a very sad message, again suggesting that a lot of our academics and intellectuals have minimized just how much children and especially teenagers need from us.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on what's happening to the children of two career families.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $10 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Mary Eberstadt, author of Home Alone America, about children of two career households.
Can you suggest some solutions to this very depressing situation?
I don't mean to be depressing. I mean, in fact, to be positive here, because I think there is a positive side to this argument, which I will get to. Solutions. There aren't any easy ones, but there are tried and true things that, again, we've minimized the power of. I'll give you an example. Sitting down as a family to dinner. Let's take that. That's a very prosaic example. What could be more ordinary than that? Well, there is, in fact, a lot of social science that convincingly links sitting down at the dinner table as a family to reduced incidences of all kinds of behaviors, for teenagers especially. Teenagers who eat dinner with their family 4 to 5 times a week, say the Council on Economic Advisers, tend to show about half the rate of alcohol drinking, are 3 times less likely to smoke, etc., etc., other consequences spelled out in my book. Now, is something magical going on at the family dinner table? I don't think so. My hypothesis would be that what's going on is that, first of all, having adults in the house makes certain behaviors less likely, and second, that kids are happier and better behaved when they see more of their moms and dads and siblings. So that might seem almost too homely and simple to be true, but when I'm asked for a practical consequence of this kind of research, that's the first thing that comes to mind.
Well, the other thing that seems to derive from that is that parents have taken the time in their schedule to be on site.
Yes, and this gets to what I think is the most positive side of the book. That is, for many years now, the yuppie generation has been told that they have to be perfect parents in a way. I mean, I see this compulsion among friends and family, too, and in my own household. The concern that we have to get just the right educational toys, or we have to find just the right kind of surrogate care arrangements, or whatever it might be. There is this tendency in our society to want to make the children excel from an early age and to say that parents are responsible for that. But in fact, if you look at the research, again, linking these kinds of problems to parental absence, it seems as if what's required of us is really something a lot simpler than that. It's not that we have to be perfect. It's that we should be around more than we are. We should be around not because that's what's going to get them into Harvard. We should be around because, frankly, it makes them happier. Now, again, that might seem like so simple-minded a formulation that you wouldn't believe it comes out of a book that purports to be about research. But there it is. They are happier with us around, and that is something that ought to weigh in the balance, too, for parents who have a choice, a genuine choice in the matter.
Well, this business, this debate that seems to be ongoing forever and ever about quantity time versus quality time, and I think we all feel if somebody takes the time to be with us, we must be worth it.
That is what individual kids feel, I'm sure, because kids aren't that different from the rest of us. But there's another point here. I don't want anyone to feel as if I'm stabbing fingers in their faces and saying, bad mommy, bad daddy. I'm not. The book isn't like that. It's not a personal book. It is a genuine attempt to just step back and look at what's going on. Another larger point is this, that you don't have to stay home. It may be you can't stay home. You can't make the financial sacrifice, or you don't want to make the sacrifice because you're very fulfilled by what you do. But the more people who do, the better society is. It doesn't have to be you. And I know that this is going out to some American servicemen and women, and I say God bless, and I want to talk to them especially because they're sacrificing very often away from their families, their children. It doesn't have to be you. If there are more adults around in the form of family and neighbors, then you can know that your kids are part of a community. You don't have to be there yourself, but it's better for everybody if there are more dads around who can take over the basketball team, for instance, or enough moms around after school so that kids can play outside again, as many cannot now because many blocks and neighborhoods are so empty of adult presence after school that kids don't have the kinds of enjoyments we had as children, being able to run around in the streets and go to the park together. We need enough adults around to make things like that possible again, and that's good for everybody. So nobody needs to feel out there as if he or she in particular is being called to stay home and make that sacrifice. I'm asking that we just acknowledge as a society that it's better for us when more people do it.
Mary, in addition to your book, Home Alone America, what resources would you suggest for parents who want to research this area further and learn a little more?
I'd first direct them to an area I don't know very much about, which is homeschooling. I think the homeschooling movement has a great deal to say about these issues. And from what I know of people who do homeschool, as I did not, they do it because they want more time with their children and they think they see the benefits there. So my first suggestion would be that people research where I have not. Second, there are in my book several pages of bibliography. There are also many, many footnotes that we've stuck in the back so that the text is easy to read. And throughout those footnotes, there are lots of books and articles mentioned that I think would be of interest to any parent. One doesn't have to be an academic to read them. There are also some other books. There's a sociologist named David Elkind who wrote a book that a lot of teachers will be familiar with and some parents too. It's called The Hurried Child, and it's about the kinds of pressure that society puts on parents and children today. It's a very interesting book that has held up over time, The Hurried Child. Another is Fatherless America by another sociologist named David Blankenhorn, written several years ago and still very influential. Fatherless America details the side of the equation that has gotten less attention, that is, how much children need their fathers in addition to their mothers. There is a book for those who are interested in the question of psychiatric drugs in kids, a best-selling book several years ago called Running on Ritalin, which is still the best book on this subject, written by a doctor named Lawrence Diller, who believes in the use of psychiatric drugs to treat kids, but also believes that this phenomenon has gone way too far and is being used on way too many kids. So Running on Ritalin, very good book there. There is finally, on the question of sexually transmitted disease, a book written by medical experts that parents and teachers should read, called The Hidden Epidemic. The foreword is by David Satcher, who was President Clinton's Surgeon General, and it's based on research by hundreds of medical professionals across the country on the question of sexually transmitted disease in general, and specifically what kinds of perils it poses for kids. So there's a handful of books that I think would be interesting to look at, even if one doesn't share the problem or think that one's kids are involved with the kind of problem. But this is the kind of research that I've relied on in Home Alone America.
Well, we are so fortunate that we've been able to have you with us today. And so thank you very much, Mary Eberstadt, for helping us sort of dissect this problem and begin to get our brain cells working on it a little bit.
Thank you very much, Sandy and Linda. It's a pleasure.
Our gift for our first caller is a copy of Mary's book, Home Alone America, by Mary Eberstadt. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address and mention show number 249. That's 1-800-791-8573. Please tell us what station you're listening to, if you can. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning into. Our latest book, Washington, D.C. with Kids, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents' Perspective and our latest book, Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. We'd like to remind you about some important toll-free numbers for parents and kids. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, 1-800-THE-LOST. That's 1-800-843-5678. And you ask for the Family Advocacy Unit. There's also a National Runaway Switchboard. All families should have this number written somewhere. 1-800-621-4000. 1-800-621-4000. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.